that type of budget, you should have two riders that are capable of winning. Because Chris, one crash, boom, he's out.
What went wrong last year? I crashed. I fell off my bike.
Halfway through the massage, there's a knock on the door, and it's Ryder, standing there with a cup for me. Made you a juice, Dave.
What's quite worrying is we're still in Derbyshire, and it feels like we've been cycling for a week.
Morale good, though?
No, not really.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello.
Hello, folks. Where are we, Lionel?
We're in the Cycling Podcast Overground Lair, the Nerve Centre HQ of our parent company or our partner company. I don't know, what would we describe it as? Dirt and Glory Media.
We are our own people, I think. We have to make that clear.
Of course. Yeah, we're completely autonomous, but we have a relationship with Dirt and Glory Media for all of the dog's body work.
We have several relationships, but before we crack on with today's podcast, where we'll be talking about Tour de Suisse, Route du Sud, the women's tour, and this is our last regular podcast before the Tour de France preview next week, and then, of course, we're off to France. But first of all, let's do the weekly roundup, Lionel.
Yeah, a bit of a bumper weekly roundup this week. Of course, one of the biggest races of the week was the Women's Tour, which was won by the German Lisa Brennauer. She inherited the leader's jersey from Lizzie Armitstead, who crashed after the finish line of the opening stage, crashed into a bank of photographers and perhaps a bit of Mick Bennett, the race director as well. The final stage was won by Britain's Hannah Barnes. She's a friend of a friend of the podcast, I believe. Girlfriend of a friend of the podcast, Theo Gegenhardt. In the men's side of things, the Tour of Switzerland concluded. Geraint Thomas came up short in the final time trial. He overhauled Thibaut Pinot, who was in the leader's jersey. But Simon Spilak went quickest. And he does very well in Swiss races, doesn't he? He's been on the podium, I think, three times at the Tour of Romandy and now won the Tour of Switzerland. But lots of riders getting ready for the tour there. Tom Dumoulin, Peter Sagan, Michael Matthews and Alexander Kristoff, who we expect to see in the first week of the tour, all winning stages. Meanwhile, in the Pyrenees at the Route du Sud, Alberto Contador and Nairo Quintana went head-to-head on the Porte de Balès. Contador opened up a gap on the descent, won the stage and took the overall honours. And it would be remiss not to mention friend of the podcast, or at least the inspiration for one of our T-shirts, Brian Cocker, also won a stage there. Meanwhile, over at the ZLM Tour in the Netherlands, André Greipel won two stages in the overall, and former Ireland champion Matt Bramia took the final stage there. Off the bike, the UCI has rewritten its rules and stated that all riders must stay in the hotels allocated to them by race organisers, which means that Team Sky cannot use the porter cabin, the big camper van that they were planning to use. I was going to call it the bed froom at the tour. Going to christen it the bed froom. No? No. Must try harder. Finally, Cycling News had a bit of a scoop. They've uncovered the brewing brouhaha between the UCI and ASO. Over all kinds of matters, I'm sure we'll discuss that in the coming weeks, but politics coming onto the radar just as the Tour de France begins. And finally, it's the National Championships this weekend, and then everyone heads to Utrecht for the Tour de France.
Must correct you there, Lionel. I think Brian Cockard, friend of the podcast, won two stages, did he not?
Yes.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
To Switzerland first, Tour de Suisse, Tour of Switzerland. I don't think you like Tour de Suisse, do you, Daniel?
Why did you say that?
I just had an old memory of you railing against people calling it Tour de Suisse.
I think it was someone else.
Oh, maybe I'm thinking of someone else. Sorry. Apologies. Maybe another Daniel. We had an email from somebody actually asking about the number of Daniels in the professional peloton, a lot of Daniels, Daniello, and asking what you thought of that. But I'm not sure, we might come back to that subject at some point. Tour of Switzerland, as you say, Lionel, won by Simon Spilak, who does have an exceptional record in Switzerland. Daniel, I think you pointed out on Twitter, not such a good record in the Grand Tours.
Yeah, he's sort of given up on Grand Tours, doesn't ride them, doesn't want to ride them. I'm not entirely sure whether he's going to ride the Tour de France this year, but I imagine that if Katusha's management would like him to ride the Tour, they might meet with some resistance from Spilak.
It's a strange one, isn't it? Because, you know, he has, you would think, the capabilities of riding well at the Tour. Is it the distance? Is it length? What is it that puts him off, do you think?
I think recovery and heat is also a problem, particularly with regard to the Tour de France. He's had big problems with the heats before, and indeed last year. Got most of the way round, but withdrew, I think, in the Pyrenees last year.
The race, of course, won by Spilak with Geraint Thomas. Maybe a surprise that he didn't overhaul him to win overall, ending up second overall in the race. Tom Dumoulin, who won both time trials. Dutch rider, a young rider, another very exciting product of the Giant Alpecin team. A really talented rider, unusual for such a big, powerful rider to have a sort of stage racing pedigree. And, you know, there are people talking about him as a potential Grand Tour winner, perhaps one day. He can climb well enough. And then perhaps he's emerging. He's obviously a time trial specialist, but he's a bit more of an all-rounder than Fabian Cancellara and Tony Martin, who have been the preeminent time trials. I thought there was an interesting sort of symbolic moment on Sunday in the final time trial. Fabian Cancellara was in the hot seat as leader and Dumoulin came in and replaced him. And I just thought that was a very symbolic moment in his home country. Cancellara, he's in decline. Is he going to win any major time trials again? Guys like Dumoulin are sort of, you know, emerging, and it's difficult to see Cancellara getting the better of guys like that in the future.
Yeah, and I certainly think looking ahead at the Tour's opening stage in Utrecht, Dumoulin will be on home soil. You know, he could well be the man who takes the yellow jersey on the opening day. And with such a question mark over Marcel Kittel's form, that would give Giant Alpecin a, you know, real kickstart to the Tour.
They remind me so much, Giant Alpecin, of HC High Road, in that they seem to have, even when their top man is misfiring, as Kittel has been, Degenkolb, now Dumoulin as well, come forward, they seem to have a sort of embarrassment of riches.
Bit of a poor man's HTC High Road, will you not say? Certainly a narrower spread of winners, regular winners. And they've actually had quite a tricky season when you take Degenkolb out of the equation. Warren Barguil has not had the best of starts to the season, although that's fairly typical of him. He has tended to come good in the Vuelta. Obviously, it's going to be his first Tour de France. A lot of expectation around what he's going to do at the Tour. Wasn't great in Switzerland. And as far as Kittel is concerned, the latest news was that he wanted to make his decision, or the team was going to make their decision, on his Tour participation in the next 48 hours. I think we're recording on Tuesday. So my hunch is that he will ride. Reports from the Giant Alpecin training camp in Sierra Nevada a couple of weeks ago were that he was going very well, actually. He did a few sprint drills against a tag team of Koen de Kort and John Degenkolb. So Degenkolb was getting a lead out and Kittel was sprinting on his own, and Kittel was beating them regularly, which suggests that his sprinting speed is getting close to what it needs to be. And that first stage of the Tour really is a perfect, or the first road stage is a perfect opportunity, because it is very flat. There'll be other kinds of perils that day, I think, coming from road furniture, the proximity to the coast, and the possibility of crosswinds. But I fully expect Kittel to be there and firing, at least on three cylinders.
Yeah, I mean, when I made the comparison with HCC, they don't have the depth of HCC, Giant Alpecin. But if you were to ask an ordinary cycling fan, have they had a good season? They have clearly had a good season with, you know, a couple of riders riding exceptionally well. Lionel, any more takeaways from the Tour de Suisse?
Well, yeah, the climbing form of Thibaut Pinot, looking very good, just as Romain Bardet did in the Critérium du Dauphiné the week before. Two French riders are coming into form just in time for the Tour, and they will have a weight of expectation on their shoulders, I am certain. But he looks in fine fettle. Nobody really expected him to hold off Geraint Thomas in the time trial. I suppose the big surprise really was that Thomas didn't get the job done. It was all set up for him, and I would have thought on that parcours, 38 kilometres, he should really have been favourite. But again, it's difficult to say, because Spilak doesn't really excel in the long time trials. When he's won at the Tour Romandy, or been on the podium at the Tour Romandy, the time trials have been a good 10, 15 kilometres shorter than that. And so it was a little bit of a surprise that he managed to beat Thomas. But nevertheless, Sky, they're coming into form as well. Froome winning the Dauphiné, Thomas on the podium in the Tour of Switzerland. Everybody's coming up. And then you look at the Route de Sud, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment. Everybody is coming up just in time.
I must say, Spilak, I don't think I've ever seen any rider less happy, apparently, to win. It was quite strange, because it was a surprise, I think, that he won, certainly to most people. We saw the news being relayed to him. I was watching it on my Eurosport player, but without any commentary. And you could see the news being relayed to him, and he just looked completely nonplussed. And throughout the podium and everything, there wasn't a hint of a smile on his face. It was quite bizarre.
Maybe being told that he'll be doing the Tour de France if he won.
I don't know. Daniel, anything else from Tour de Suisse about Thibaut Pinot in particular, maybe?
Well, obviously his performance, well, both in the Tour of Switzerland and the Tour de Romandie earlier this year, has whetted the appetite, certainly, of the French public. He really seems to have made another step up this year. Obviously finished on the podium of the Tour de France last year, but this season seems to have joined the very top echelon of climbers and beaten the top climbers a la Pedal. Certainly in Romandie, you beat Nairo Quintana and Chris Froome. He is obviously under a lot of pressure. He will, I think, possibly struggle in the first week, although he insists that he's not worried, he's not scared about the first week. He has recaed the cobbled stages. I actually think he might go quite well over the cobbles. Francis Dijon is one of these teams that has taken a very sort of an aggressive, practical approach to the recaes they've done of the cobbled stage. They've ridden it at race pace. They've been very adamant about the need to do that. We spoke about that quite a lot last year, didn't we? The difference between the approaches of teams when they go to look at that stage. So, and Francis Dijon have upped the ante in terms of equipment. They've done a lot of work on their equipment this year. Steve Morabito has been a great signing for them from BMC. He has also brought a lot of expertise, a lot of know-how as far as nutrition and equipment is concerned, and he'll be very valuable for Pinot at the Tour de France. Morabito himself was in the top 10 in Switzerland, wasn't he? I mean, the big question mark, I think, as I say, for Pinot is the first week. And also, you know, we saw his vulnerability again in terms of racecraft at the Tour of Switzerland. He lost, I think, in three consecutive days, he lost a handful of seconds in small splits towards the end of stages. And we've spoken a lot about how complicated the finale is going to be in that first week. But, you know, we don't expect him to win the Tour de France. Maybe the French hope that he might. We don't expect him to. So he doesn't need to be right at the business end, at the arrowhead of the peloton every day, fighting for, you know, the odd second here and there. He can afford to maybe concede a minute or even 2 minutes in that first week, because there are so many opportunities for him in the Pyrenees and particularly the Alps.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Okay, coming up on British Eurosport this weekend, the British National Road Race Championships. For the first time, showing the men's and the women's races on British Eurosport, and then that'll be the last sort of engagement on British Eurosport before Tour de France kicks off, of course, a week later. Always good to watch the national championships. And Lionel, you at the weekend, I think, took in some of the women's tour in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, I did. I went up to Stevenage for the finish of stage four, which was won by Lisa Brennau when she regained the leader's jersey. And then I went out, rode my bike out onto the final climb at Tom's Hill near Tring in Hertfordshire, and watch them come up there. And have to say, both in Stevenage and on the climb at Tring, the crowds were huge. I mean, it made me think that the women's tour, this is the second edition of the race, is kind of ahead of where the modern Tour of Britain was in 2005, when I think that would have been the second event there. And I think the most striking thing, particularly, I know it's only a sort of snapshot from my brief visit there, but the most striking thing was the diversity of the crowds. It's not just a cycling club crowd of people that are going out to watch, it's families and children, and it's become a sporting event in its own right, really. And the racing itself, bunch sprints every day, perhaps not the most diverse in terms of the challenges, but that's because of the geography. You know, the a lot of riding on relatively flat roads. Not saying it was easy at all. The leg over the Chilterns on the final day, very difficult, with lots of uncategorised climbs as well as two quite significant climbs on the course. The big news, of course, though, was on the first day, Lizzie Armitstead crashed, crossed the line, having won the stage, arms in the air, and then appeared to wobble a bit or swerve a bit, collided with the bank of photographers, and Mick Bennett, the race director, appeared to be trying to get the photographers out of the way. I tried to speak to Mick on Saturday in Stevenage, but he was rather elusive. I didn't catch sight of him at all afternoon. Not sure he's done a lot of media over the course of the week, perhaps just wanting the incident to die down, because it didn't look great, did it, to see the highest profile rider in the race win the stage, take the leader's jersey, but be unable to ride the following day because of a freak crash, really. But from talking to people on the race, they said that all of the UCI regulations have been adhered to. The photographers, a lot of people commenting on Twitter that the photographers were too close. Well, there is a regulation distance that they have to be from the finish line. And if there's one thing that I know about Mick from his years organising the Tour of Britain and other events, it's that he does prioritise rider safety, and certainly wouldn't have allowed anybody to across that line. He's very strict about who is allowed in the finish straight. If you don't have the right credentials, you're not allowed in there. So it was just one of those things. And I think the unfortunate thing was that it was such a high profile event at the start of the race, and it denied the public the chance to see Lizzie Armitstead race. But then Hannah Barnes stepped up into that void, won a stage, won the best young rider jersey, won the best British rider jersey. So overall, I think a very successful week.
Yeah, I mean, that's been an accident waiting to happen, though, hasn't it? The bunch sprints. The photographers have to be there to capture the images. You know, there's always a bit of hoping for the best, because you don't know what side of the road the sprinters are going to... You can take a decent guess at what side of the road they're going to come at you at. There was quite a near miss at the Dauphiné recently with Nasser Bouhanni. I thought there was a slow motion replay of him crossing line, arms in the air, and he had to sort of get back down again very quickly and swerve out of the way. So it's a miracle it doesn't actually happen more often. And I think there was maybe some wind as well that day that maybe caught Lizzie Armitstead's wheel. That was one theory.
Napalm, you mentioned the route, the women's tour, and there were some grumbles about the lack of diversity of the route. It was too flat, too easy. Can you just explain what are the challenges facing the organisers in terms of geography? Are they tied to a particular region? Is that why there were so many stages that on paper at least seem to be very alike?
Well, first of all, like the men's tour of Britain, they are dependent on places that want to host the event. Now, I'm sure everyone will be saying, oh, bring it to Scotland, bring it to the northwest, bring it to the northeast, wherever. But the company that runs both the Tour of Britain and the women's tour are trying to work both events in tandem, really. And they are trying to maximise and make the best races they possibly can from the interest that's expressed to them by towns and regions that want to host the race. So if you look at the last 2 years, the men's tour of Britain has kind of been north and more west, and the women's tour was in the kind of southeast East Anglia area last year, a similar sort of course this year. You can't conjure up big climbs in Essex and Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire. You know, they're not there. But the Chilterns is a challenging enough place to ride, and it could have been a really explosive stage if more than one rider had attacked in the finale. As it was, Claudia Lichtenberg was the only rider that went off the front. If that had been a small group and they'd gained a minute and a half, 2 minutes, they might have had a chance to go to the finish. But as it was, the bunch were, you know, they were pretty alert. And to be fair, in Stevenage, it had been a hard ride. It had been drizzly and wet, and they had a very technical run in the last 10 kilometres. Two riders were off the front. Eliza Longo-Borghini was one of them, and they nearly made it to the line. So although they were bunch sprints, it wasn't that they were particularly sort of uneventful stages, but you can't sort of conjure up big climbs where there aren't any. And the race organisers are having to put the event on in areas that are expressing interest in hosting it. In 5 days, they can't go from sort of Scotland down to the southeast. And I think the idea to keep it in a much more compact area, and particularly the women's tour to have it in roughly the same sorts of areas last year and this year, has given it a real boost. It's established it very early, and probably a lot more awareness of it this year was why the crowds were so big.
People see me kicking off on that, but if I'm in the wrong, I'm always the first to apologise. And someone just trying to get a quote out of me, it rubs me up the wrong way. He'd said to me since I was 15 years old or something, like, oh, you're the next Robin McEwen. I think there's one defining moment I can gauge straight away someone showing me respect or not. The fact that people still talk about me losing a race 10 years after I turned pro shows that I'm not actually losing that much.
At Home with Mark Cavendish, a Friends of the Podcast special.
For the latest special episode of the Cycling Podcast, recorded exclusively for Friends of the Podcast, Daniel Freeb travelled to Italy to spend time with Mark Cavendish.
My points, I don't back down. My points about things, but I think the way I approached it and the way I behaved around it was pretty unacceptable. He was my boss. You see all this crashing that's going on in the Giro. It's MGC riders. And normally, I don't answer a cold call from a journalist, you know. I did him a favour, I answered the phone. The only people that are going to use this quote are people with not even a vendetta, just someone who wants to spite me.
This is Mark Cavendish, as you've never heard him before.
We went out, we went for afternoon tea. We went to the Lion King with Delilah. That was wicked. I was almost crying. I was seeing how excited she was.
To listen to the full interview with Mark Cavendish, become a friend of the podcast online at thecyclingpodcast.com. It's just £5.
Okay, you heard a little teaser there for our new Friends special podcast, available to Friends of the Podcast. Sign up at www.thecyclingpodcast.com. Become a friend for £5 for the year. We've released 3 specials already, but they'll be coming thick and fast now. We've got the Cavendish special, which is Daniel Freeb at home with Mark Cavendish. That's at Mark Cavendish's home in Italy. Very interesting conversation that he had with Mark Cavendish out there. Next week, all being well, we will be releasing another Friends special, which was our event last week at Foyle's Bookshop in London. The three of us did an event there in front of an audience, and it was quite good fun. It was our perfect Tour de France. We selected 21 stages and talked briefly about them until being interrupted by a bell. And then we took some questions at the end. So that was good fun, and that'll be released next week. All these Friends specials will be behind our new paywall, and Friends will receive instructions as to how to access them, and hopefully that'll all go without a hitch. We hope, fingers crossed. Coming up during in the tour as well, we've got our PERC, the Podcast Independent Reform Commission, our exhaustive look at the subject of doping in cycling. Daniel's nodding confidently. Is it exhaustive, Daniel?
Exhaustingly compiled
over several months. But the tour is the time when doping is at the forefront, when there are lots of questions about doping. I mean, don't mean doping is at the forefront. I mean, as a subject rather than the practice of doping is at the forefront. The subject is one that people are all talking about. Hopefully a lot of the questions will be answered in there, and we won't have to talk about it every day in our regular podcast. That's the idea, isn't it? At the tour, we're going to be doing two podcasts. I think we can announce that now. We're going to be doing a morning podcast called Kilometre Zero, which will be a sort of sideways look at the Tour de France, our journey around France in our Jaguar car. We're sponsored by Jaguar again this year. Thank you to them. And then the evening show will be the regular show. In total, it should be about 45 minutes. In total, 10, 15 minutes show in the morning, 25 minutes show in the evening. So shouldn't be too much listening to burden you with there, but hopefully most people will listen to both those podcasts. We're looking forward to it, aren't we, chaps?
Certainly are. This time next week, we'll be on our way.
I'm getting the Jaguar delivered on Thursday, actually. Looking forward to that immensely. Have a weekend cruising around the mean streets of South London. Anyway, we've got another race to talk about before we wrap up proceedings this week. That's the Route du Sud, and that saw Nairo Quintana back in action for the first time since Tour de Romandie, end of April, I think it is, or into May, perhaps early May. Anyway, he's been away a long time training in Colombia, and he was up against Alberto Contador, his first race since winning the Giro d'Italia. Seemed to carry some of that form into the Route du Sud. Quite surprised. Did Contador have to race between the Giro and the Tour?
I think he would probably have been slightly nervous if he had not raced. I mean, he's skipping the Spanish National Championships this weekend because he obviously needs some rest between the Route du Sud and the start of the Tour. But I think it was also probably a chance to refine certain mechanisms in the team. There were some riders in the Route du Sud who we will see again at the Tour de France. And what we saw was, well, we saw one real head-to-head encounter, didn't we, between Contador and Quintana on the Port de Balaise, very difficult climb above Luchon. They went over the top together, and Contador attacked Quintana on the descent. And Quintana is a Colombian who doesn't have the stereotypical reputation of Colombian climbers of yore as being a very bad descender. But Contador made him look, I wouldn't say stupid, but he certainly exposed what looks to be a weakness in Quintana's armoury, doesn't it?
Well, Quintana, of course, had a very nasty crash, didn't he, at the Vuelta last year, going downhill in a time trial. And you wonder if there's some legacy of that. You know, riders will often be a bit more calculating. There'll be an element of fear where perhaps there wasn't before. And I wonder if that plays on his mind at all. Who knows? Did we learn much, though, Lionel, about Quintana's condition?
We learned that he's reasonably good and that he will be going to the Tour de France in good shape. I mean, we know that all four, Chris Froome, Nairo Quintana, Alberto Contador, Vincenzo Nibali, are all in good shape. None of them are really showing peak form, but none of them are showing any obvious signs of weakness either. And I think that's what everybody... I don't want to reduce the Tour de France to a race of four men, but it's a lot more preferable to see a race between four men than to see a race that's won by just one of them. And I think the most encouraging thing is...
It will be won by just one of them.
Well, it will be won
or by... Or someone else.
It will be won by just one of them. But what I mean is, last year, the race was reduced to the Vincenzo Nibali show after 10 days. And we're very much hoping that that doesn't happen again this year. And to have them all jostling for kind of position as we get to the start line, I think is fantastic.
It's tantalising, isn't it?
Yeah, and just on the Route du Sud and Quintana's performance, a consensus seemed to be growing over the last few weeks that Quintana was possibly the outstanding favourite for the Tour de France. I think that's perhaps been revised slightly as a result of his performance in the Route du Sud. We can't draw too many conclusions. You know, it was his first race for quite some time, but the troubles he had on the descent, I should mention that it's not a particularly difficult descent. It's a very fast descent. I remember in the Route du Sud a few years ago, Anthony Chateau was leading the race and he went over the top in pretty good shape and he got the yips on the descent and he lost about 4 minutes on that descent. But the descending is a little bit of a concern as far as Quintana is concerned. When you look at the Tour route and you think of, I can think of at least three stages when, given the opposition that he'll be up against, so that's Nibali, Contador in particular, there is scope there for things to go wrong for Quintana. And I'm thinking particularly about the stage to Courtrai where they come down Tourmalet and it's a quite a fast descent, not the most technical, but quite fast. Then the descent of the Col d'Alos in the Alps, which we've mentioned before, was featured in the Dauphiné. Romain Bardet took off there and won the stage in Praloup in the Dauphiné there and is very, very tricky. And then also the stage to Gap, which we've seen that cause problems in the past, the descent off the Col de Mont. So that's certainly an element of this year's tour, certainly with so many contenders. We've talked a lot about the Big Four or the Cuatro Galacticos. You can guarantee that someone is going to look to take advantage of those descents, probably Nibali, perhaps Contador. So
on two previous occasions on that, on Col de Mont and to Gap in 2011 and 2013, Contador has caused quite a lot of trouble. He ran Chris Froome off the road briefly, didn't he, in 2013? And it does remind me of, you know, whatever condition Contador is in, whether he's recovered or not from the Giro, I think he will be a guy who will not, whatever position he's in, he will animate things, he will attack, he will not give up, he will have an influence on the outcome of the race, even if it's not winning. I mean, I think of 2011 when he was really out of it overall, and those last few days he really did sort of light several bonfires, didn't he?
As will Nibali. And also on Quintana, I don't know if you guys caught Chris Froome's interview with David Walsh in the Sunday Times this weekend, in which he talked about Quintana's climbing and sort of dispelled this idea that Quintana is head and shoulders above everyone as a climber. Froome suggested that he's more afraid of Contador, and particularly Contador's ability to accelerate very fast in the mountains, that Quintana is a climber that tends to keep a fairly even pace, and Froome doesn't seem to be concerned by the likelihood of being dropped by Quintana in the mountains.
Quintana is obviously a tremendous climber, but the image you have of him is just sitting there rock steady, riding at a very consistent pace. He doesn't tend to accelerate. It's a pretty high consistent pace, that being said. Shall we wrap it up there, chaps? We wanted to do a shorter than usual podcast because you've got a lot of listening to do. Cavendish special will be up this week. Foyle special next week. We've got a Tour de France preview next week as well. So there's a lot coming up. So let's all go away and watch the national championships this weekend. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.